For World Mental Health Week, this is Walk In My Shoes Radio, broadcasting live from St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, Dublin 8.
With the right support, we can all enjoy life. Taking that first step is possible with St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. If you have concerns about your mental health, talk to your GP or call our support line on 01 249 3333. Don't wait to enjoy life again. St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. Empowering recovery.
I Feel It Coming Too. That's The Weeknd featuring Daft Punk. I Feel It Coming. It is 7 minutes past 10 o'clock here on Walk In My Shoes FM, broadcasting live from St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, right in the lobby. And all life is happening here as well. We've service users, we've service givers, we have people who are working, people are delivering, we have receptions going on, people arguing with the car park machine. All life is here today as well. And this is our last day on Walk In My Shoes FM. Available for podcasting as well, or for podcasts. Walk In My Shoes. Delphine was up till 1 o'clock this morning making podcasts. Pat O'Mahony show, I know, and various different things as well. So you can always look back. We're here for advice and help, and all the numbers you need are on walkinmyshoes.ie. Now, I am joined by Eileen Finnegan, Clinical Director of 1 in 4. And when I Googled her, I didn't expect to find her in a wetsuit covered in mud. Why were you in a wetsuit covered in mud on the website?
Why am I in a wetsuit? Well, I suppose in working for a charity, one of the things is it's not just about delivering a one-to-one psychotherapy service. Sometimes you have to go out of your comfort zone. And I was in a wetsuit doing hell and back, of which I still have a dodgy knee from. And I suppose it's quite interesting that you picked that picture, because a lot of the clients that come to 104 often say that they feel they've been to hell and back. And I thought that was certainly one way that I could, obviously, not experience either sexual abuse or any type of sexual violence. But I thought, well, actually, it'll give me a little bit of understanding of hell and back. Now, it was something that I obviously could recover from physically, but it did really make me aware of just what it was like to really have to negotiate a terrain that was really, really difficult, and not knowing what was going to be ahead of me. So I think it had a really powerful analogy for me, and it has left me. I've done lots of other things. You didn't see me in my parachute jump and my bungee jumping and lots of other things. When you're working for a charity, it's not just about delivering the service, it is about fundraising, and I suppose people really taking mental health seriously in relation to the impact.
People know the name 1 in 4. They may not be 100% familiar with the background to 1 in 4. Maybe you might give us just a little bit of background, and you said you mentioned one-to-one psychotherapy. Yeah. You might just give us a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So 1 in 4 was started in 2003, and it's quite interesting. I've been there since 2005. It initially started with Colm O'Gorman. I think that's where a lot of people in relation to the Catholic Church and in relation to all of the Savvy report and all that. However, it has totally changed. 1 in 4 has totally changed in that we work in all areas of sexual violence. So I work with individuals that have experienced abuse, individuals that have perpetrated abuse, and families of both. So it's a very systemic approach. And I suppose when we're talking about mental health, it's not only what that has brought us into as clinicians, it's not only the mental health of the individuals that I see every day, it's also the mental health of the staff. It's a very, very difficult area to work in. It's not very popular. I'm not very popular for a lot of the work I do, yet it's really trying to get the voice of everybody in sexual violence.
Your professional background?
So I've been a psychotherapist for over 25 years, and you're constantly in training. So I suppose I would come from a lot of different modalities. I suppose my trade would be a psychotherapist. So I'm the clinical director now, so I oversee all the programs in 1 in 4.
You mentioned two things I want to pick up on. One is that you're not always popular. Why do you say that?
I think I'm not always popular, and the organisation hasn't been popular in recent years, because we began to do some work with individuals that have offended. And I think that was a real challenge for all of us. It was something I had never imagined I would be doing, but victims began, as they began to share their story, what they began to share was, well, actually, the abuse didn't happen necessarily within the Catholic Church or by a stranger. It was by someone known, somebody what we would call either intrafamilial abuse or even maybe not a family member. And what they wanted to know, which really...
So you're talking about a brother, sister, uncle, a direct family member, or somebody, a second removed?
No, a direct family member.
Or somebody who was taken in as a family member, the neighbour who spent all their time in the house with them. So somebody who's part of
known.
A family. Yeah, and known to the family. Sorry for interrupting.
No, that's absolutely fine. And I think that in the part of... what I was saying was, it's very much a victim-led, so that challenged me hugely in, you know, you talk about mental health and all of that, even for myself, and thinking, how am I going to manage if these individuals want me to actually understand or ask the individual that has offended, why did you do that? Because the biggest thing for me was that they wanted to stay in relationship with the individual that offended, and certainly from a child protection point of view, that certainly made me very anxious as a clinician.
So can we just take an example just to give people to ground that. So let's take a female in a family and a brother is the abuser.
Take that
situation. They don't want the brother ostracized. They don't want to never see him again. They want to see if he can be rehabilitated.
Well, I think that in the first place, if we go back a little bit, if you think about when someone in a family where there has been a disclosure, and most times the disclosure will come from the victim, one of the things that the families have to manage is what is going to happen if society hears, if this gets out into the media, if this gets out into the public arena, there's going to be mayhem. So that puts huge pressure on the victim. Yet the family do want the person not to reoffend. So it's really is a very much a catch-22 and a real Sophie's choice for a parent of, you know, I have met parents who have said to me, and I was only talking about this yesterday, you know, a parent with a 20-year-old son who's said that she would have preferred if her son had died at birth rather than have gone on and offended. And there is that part of it, and I would wonder, is that because of society will say that they're not able to be reintegrated or what it is? And I suppose whether I have an opinion on whether individuals can be reintegrated or not, I really need to listen to the clients that are coming and are saying, we want this person, not all clients, but we want this person to be part of our family. We just don't want the offending to continue. So that's a huge challenge, and I think for us as a society we really need to start listening to what victims are saying, because if we don't, they're not going to tell us that there's an offender in their house, and therefore the offender will think it's no big deal. What needs to happen is that we don't have that stone them and, you know, do something really bad, because at the end of the day, for me, my anxiety level is if they're left in a home or not, they have no consequence, they will actually take that. They don't think the same way as we do, so they will think that, well, actually, that's okay. It isn't any big deal.
There are no consequences.
And the consequences, and therefore then the victim is left for the rest of their life carrying this.
Are you under an obligation to report when you are told of an allegation of sexual abuse? Are you under obligation to report that to the legal authorities?
Yeah, no, we would always have done that in 104. We've always had, and we're absolutely delighted that the Children First guidelines are coming in, we've always had a mandatory reporting policy, for the simple reason is that we believe that when an individual has experienced sexual violence, for them to really repair is that the person who has offended takes responsibility, and whether that means absolutely being acknowledged to the authorities, whether the person acknowledges that, but it is really important for victims to know that the professionals are responsible for actually reporting that somebody has told us that they know of somebody that has offended.
Can you remember the first time that you dealt with an offender in the 1 in 4 context? I know you've been a psychotherapist for 25 years, you probably come across all sorts of different situations, but as a 1 in 4 person, do you remember the first time that meeting occurred?
Yeah, I remember the first time, and every time I meet an individual, it feels like the first time. I feel the very first time, actually, the meeting the individual that has offended, I suppose there was a part of me that was nearly aware of what I was going to hear. What I wasn't prepared for was when I met the families and their level of distortion. And the very first mother that I met, whose niece had been offended against her husband, and she told me that her 8-year-old niece had been a slut since she was 2. So that absolutely blew me out of the water, and I realised, well, actually, speaking to the individual that has offended, I had an understanding of what it is that I'm possibly going to hear, the cognitive distortions. What I wasn't prepared for was the system that person was in. So when that person was leaving 1 in 4, they would be going home to their wife or their mother, who was then, don't mind those people in 1 in 4, especially that Eileen Finnegan one, she's just calling you a paedophile. So I realised that a huge part of my work was not as much with the individuals that are offended, but with the family and moving into that system in a very delicate way, because it is very intrusive. People are in terrible shock, in denial and despair, whether I like that or not. But it's not a very pleasant thing that people are coming into their home to actually investigate with them. But that has been the biggest personal and remains to be the biggest shock to me when I hear, especially with young men who have offended on the internet, really, really horrendous abuse, and their parents will say, well, they never touched a child. So that makes, that really are the times when I maybe lose sleep at night time, when I think I may have somebody who's coming into 1 in 4 who gets it, understands it, may want, you know, to put the factors in not to reoffend, and then they're going home into a system that is minimizing what they have done. So that's actually probably has been far worse for me than some of the contamination of the information that I've heard from offenders.
When you hear something like that, how do you deal with, I mean, I'm sure you hear, the adrenaline starts to rush and the anger.
Yeah.
How do you suppress that? How do you stop jumping? I know you're professional,
yeah,
but still you're human.
Well, I think you also need to have the conversation with the individual. You need to let the individual know in as much in a non-judgmental way. But I mean, I certainly would be very straight and I would have that conversation. As I said, I don't believe in treatment. I believe in risk management. So that means that the individual really needs to be able to tell me what were the motivating factors. So for me, it's like, yes, there may be times that I'm angry. Most of the times the anger or the rage will really get when there's cognitive distortions, when they're really minimizing.
Can you just explain what you mean by...
Minimize or rationalize. So therefore we only work with individuals that accept responsibility. And that is remembering that all individuals come onto the program because they've been caught. I have not yet met any offender who has come because they have felt they have done something wrong. Yes, so that level of remorse that you will meet, yes, and they would say they're delighted to be caught and all of that. But, you know, I would wonder how genuine it is.
When I knew you were coming on, we were going to talk about this, I read some evidence from the UK and some studies from the UK as well that would say if the offenders thought that there wasn't a legal implication that they might come forward to be treated, that they may voluntarily come forward, but they know that you have to report, so therefore the whole legal implication comes in as well.
Yeah, and I think so. Everyone that comes onto the Phoenix program, that's the name of the program, would be reported to the Child and Family Agency and the superintendent in their area. The big thing for us is a lot of those individuals will never go through the criminal justice system because the victim doesn't want that to happen.
So the DPP doesn't have enough evidence and enough cooperation to mount a prosecution, a successful prosecution.
Yeah. Well, the victim... The victim is the person who the crime has happened against, so they don't want to go forward. So from a child protection point of view, so I work very closely with the social workers. We have a very good working relationship. So our job is really about child protection. As far as we're concerned, that individual has offended. Yes, we will support the individual and hope that in their lifetime they don't do it again. But our primary concern is for the children that they will have contact with and for the families that they're actually living in. So while working in this area has been very difficult, the information that I have gathered, that I'm hoping that society will now begin to sieve through, it's almost like we've had to go in right into the front line to get the information. And, you know, the information I have gotten is very different from what I would have ever imagined, and the level of distortions, people minimising, justifying, all of those things, and just the harm that has happened to children. And I suppose what we have to do with the society is, what do we do with that information now? It's not enough just to have that information and say, oh, that's terrible. It's like, well, what do we do and how can this inform prevention in the future? And that's really where I would feel, and that's when you ask me about, you know, how do I, well, you didn't necessarily say how do I sleep at night, but for me, once an individual is sitting opposite me, he has his back or she has her back to children, and therefore there's a possibility the children may be safe in the future. And that really is, if I have any legacy in this work, that is it, is that we can find ways from listening to these individuals, and they tell us it's very easy to offend. It's very easy to offend in the comfort of your own home and your own bed, and you know that the children won't speak out because their family know, oh my God, if this happens. We have to change that for victims. We have to change that they're not going to hear the response from society. That they're going to have a response from society is, it is a terrible thing that has happened, however, we will manage the individual and they may need to be taken out of the house, but it's not your fault.
I'm breathless listening because there's so much there as well. And the fact that the offender doesn't have a legal judgment against them, they're not on the sex offenders register, yeah, they have admitted to a crime but are not to be prosecuted, then there has to be some informal way of dealing with them. And that's what you're talking about, an informal system.
Absolutely. And that's where the Child and Family Agency come in. So even though there isn't, they're not going through the criminal justice, like in fairness to the social workers and the Child and Family Agency, they work really, really well in protecting children. And that really is, you know, I know in 104 we work with a lot of retrospective cases where there's a lot of... they haven't had the support maybe that they needed. But certainly I would say in the current cases and where that we work so closely with the Child and Family Agency that there really is, we're all on that page of children need to be safe. And once we have information in the here and now that somebody is in that house, we need to do something about it. And I think that...
And can social workers take action if there's a disclosure?
Absolutely. So social workers, and that's where really where the work is, the social workers can go in, the individuals have to be part of a very specific program in 104 with the social workers, and that's a significant individual program, which means we decide as professionals, whether or not we feel that you, as the person who wants to support the offender, is actually a significant individual. Will you phone the police if you notice anything wrong? Will you phone the Child and Family Agency? You need to be the guards, the social worker, the clinicians. That's what you need to be in order for us to feel that you can actually protect a child.
Are there any other offender-led, or victim-led, but treating offenders? Any other programmes in Ireland treating offenders?
There's not any community-based, and that is the difficulty, and that is how 104 ended up doing it. It wasn't, it was, Granada had been there years ago, Granada has gone. So there is no other community-based treatment.
Arbor Hill, where most sex offenders are in prison, there is a programme, but you have to volunteer for it.
Yeah.
The resources are quite slim, I believe.
Yeah. But the thing about it is all of those programmes are for high-risk offenders. The individuals that we may meet may not necessarily meet the criteria for high-risk offenders, and that's why I don't like doing risk assessments, although I'm qualified to do it, because I don't like low, medium or high. What does that mean? Somebody is high, low or medium of reoffending. So it's like, so a lot of those that are part of SORM would be high-risk offenders. So there are so many that would actually fall through the net. And if you think that, you know, I've worked with over 300 offenders, and if you think that each offender would, you know, offend against at least two children, that's 600 children alone. And that's a very small number of individuals that offend. It's not an easy program. It's a very difficult program. It's a very challenging program. And I mean, I'm not interested in individuals that are coming on a program because they're mandated. They're not mandated. They have to come, they have to pay.
When you say mandated, this is part of a probation, or it's part of a plea, trying to reduce their sentence or some other mechanism.
Absolutely. And you know, when a solicitor asks me for a report, it's very, very rare that they would bring a report that I have done into court, because they would feel that it is actually would go against the offender. But it's a very factual, and it's like, if you want to be on the program, and we would only work with individuals that would plead guilty. You know, we're not interested. And yet there are others, you know, there are other maybe private organisations that do. We are not, because it is so victim-led, and we know what victims have to go through the criminal justice system. The last thing that we want to do is make that even harder for them by negotiating with somebody that has not taken responsibility.
When you have an offender sitting in front of you, do you ever get to like that person?
It's a very interesting question, and I was at a conference yesterday, and I was just talking about the very first time I was in supervision, and I was very fortunate that Niall Muldoon, the Ombudsman man, was actually my supervisor at the time, and I said to him, I have a terrible fear that I'm going to like any of them. What if I like any of them? Will that make me feel that I'm groomed? Although, like, all of us are groomed every day, you know. It's like, get this makeup and you look 10 years younger, or this hair stuff. So it's like, I was very anxious. And then, so with the older men, when I say the older men, maybe the over 40s, I was able to manage that in that it didn't really bother me. But when it came to the 19 to 25-year-olds, I struggled. I have a 30-year-old son. And when I saw these, I have five brothers, and so many of them were at very similar stages to my own brothers. And you know, they were young men in college, in lots of places, and I was thinking, God, nobody would ever know. They're living quite functioning lives. They're not what I would have thought with these individuals living in,
because,
you know.
Because there's a trench coat, unshaven, living in darkness.
Yeah.
These are people living in the light.
Absolutely. Out there, right there. And, you know, we used to have rooms up in Georgia Street, and I used to be amazed every week when I would open the door and sort of out they would go, and I would think, you know, nobody knows that these individuals are just literally walking on the street. And actually one day I was on the bus into town, and this man got on the bus really well dressed, professional job, stood up, and he was standing there, a lovely summer day, biting into an apple, and, you know, quite a handsome man. And I was looking at him thinking, nobody knows except me, well, I don't know who you are. I have met you in the rooms in 1 and 4, and yet here you are. Nobody, if anyone got on the bus and said, is there anyone on this bus that looks like what we would imagine an individual that offend looks like? It was no. And I was just thinking, God, if you only heard what comes out his mouth, his level of distortion, the minimizing. So the individuals are definitely a lot closer than sometimes we might like to think they are.
You talked about legacy and things you'd like to think that you've left behind in the positive light. At some stage, you'll have to move on. You know, you'll do something. You'll move on somewhere else.
Yeah.
You'll retire. You'll do something.
Yeah.
You won't be with 1 and 4. Mm. You won't be working on these programs. What would you like to see in the future? What would you like to see in the next 5 years with this particular
Yeah, what I've always wanted, you know, even as a child, and I'm 55 now, but even as a child, I always wondered how come adults could see things happening to small children and didn't do anything about it. So that has always been, you know, I always felt I wanted to be like a Christina Noble going in there and pulling children out. I didn't realise that it was going to have to be not as directly working with children in the way I wanted, but I do feel that over the next 5 years, what I would like is for people to be talking about, you know, even educating young children, what is normal sex? What is, you know, I was at a conference yesterday and all that nervousness about what young people are looking at on the internet. So that is really what I would like. I would like to see really good, robust conversations to help young people to understand what's appropriate sex, what's normal. Sex is a very, very enjoyable, a very wonderful thing, and can have a very positive outcome. Children are born from it, lots of things. And I think for us to be able to talk and have healthy relationships about sex, because I think that a lot of the individuals that I would have met along the way, especially the younger men, you know, when I look at some of their lives, I'm talking to young men who are telling me that they've been in their bedroom for like 6 and 7 years for 11 hours a day on the internet, like since they were 11. I'm very involved in sport. I love sport, head and back, and anything is dangerous. I'm thinking, what parent, you know, if that was, I was recently looking at a new playground, and I was listening to parents saying, oh, that's very high for them, and that's very, oh God, if they fell off that. And I thought, God almighty, do you ever think about the risks of what your children are doing online and what they're learning about sex? So I suppose that would be, is coming back into just, you know, that mulligan oiga agus chucky she, and that's really what I would like, is just to remember children and think about it. It's like, because at the end of the day, I always think about a little guy I met. He was 4, and I remember having to move on from a family resource centre, and I was more brokenhearted than he was. And he said to me, he couldn't say my name, he's called me Lylene. He said, Lylene, it doesn't matter. He said, because I know you're going to find out why big people hurt little people. And that has stayed with me. For over 20 years, and I met him recently. Oh. And
how's he doing?
He's doing really, really well, and against a lot of the odds. But he's actually training in childcare, and is really so that, and it's like, and he follows me in any little places that he sees me, and it's like, if that one person's life is changed by thinking that adults, as adults, that we are responsible for protecting children in the future.
And on the offenders, what would you like? Would you like to see a formal state-led program being put in place?
Absolutely.
And funded?
Absolutely, because our program is not funded. I have people coming from all over Ireland. I feel if there was, you know, at the conference yesterday, it was like, if I could only make 10 of me, they wanted. I think that there should be absolutely similar programs rolled out. I would love, and you say in the future, I would love to train people up to be able to deliver this work and support them, because, you know, you do need the support, and you can only actually sit, I would believe, you know, you don't have longevity in this work. Certainly sitting opposite somebody who's telling you the details of their offending, you cannot erase that. And the biggest losses for me is I can't watch SVU anymore. CSI, all those programs.
Any of these procedural crime, yeah, forensics, anything,
yeah,
like that?
I can't watch those anymore. It's a yes to the dress is about the sum total now of half as much as I can do in the telly. Or I haven't reached the Kardashians yet, but I don't think that'll be too far away from me. But that's the sum total that my brain can take.
Wow.
All of those. So there has been a loss. I'm not as bad now. I don't follow men around in playgrounds if I see them. I've lost that a little bit.
Did you lose faith in men?
Oh, I lost, yeah. Well, I lost faith in men a little bit, but also in women, because a lot of the clients that come to 104, the victims, have actually been offended against by females. So it's like, so there's that part of, you know, there's a huge amount that's out there, you know, and I was asked recently, I would say maybe about 20% of individuals are offended against by females, but we're afraid, that's another radio show, but another part of my legacy is in certainly wanting to see that voice of why is it that people are afraid to say that they have been offended against by a female.
If people are listening today and they want to contact 104, if they're an offender, they can't contact you directly. Can they?
Yeah,
they
no, they absolutely
if
can.
If they're sitting at home listening and saying, you know, I've done some things and there's victims of, my victims are there, I don't know what to do, you know, and you'll tell them fairly straight, fairly quickly what they need to do.
Well, I think it's really important to know that I'm a clinician, and it's very easy to sit opposite somebody that has been harmed and have empathy. You have to dig a bit deeper to have empathy for somebody that has harmed. But I still think it takes an awful lot of courage for anyone to sit in a therapeutic space. So for me, anyone that makes that call, I don't get into the content from the beginning. I get into that part of the journey that you've made to sit opposite someone, to tell them your story, whatever your story is.
And contact details?
Well, the contact details is 1 in 4.
Just Google 1 in 4.
I think it's Google. info@1in4.ie and 0.
You're obviously not in charge of the IT system.
No, it is. And someone else can look up the Twitter, but it is. It's look up 1 in 4. And actually, we have a fabulous new website, seemingly, that has just gone live. Seemingly. From the IT people.
You signed the check.
No, I wish I did sign the check. I wouldn't be here. I'd be in Barbados if I was signing the check.
Eileen, thank you so much for coming. I think that's the first time I've heard that. I have to be honest. I listen to a lot of radio and I read a lot of the internet. I read a lot of newspapers as well. But that's the most honesty. I've had tears in my eyes a couple of times as well. So I apologize for that. Mm. It's not about me, but it hit me in the heart there a couple of times, especially the four-year-old. That was very powerful. Yeah. That's Eileen Finnegan, Clinical Director of 1 in 4. You're listening to Walk In My Shoes Radio. Let's take some music and we've got more coming up in a few minutes.
Symphonies. Before all I heard was silence, a rhapsody for you and me, and every melody is timeless. Life was stringing me along, then you came and you cut me loose, was solo singing on my own. Now I can't find the key without you, and now you're
Clayton, and you're listening to Walk In My Shoes Radio, broadcasting live from St. Patrick's University Hospital this October to mark World Mental Health Day.
With the right support, we can all enjoy life. Taking that first step is possible, with St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. If you have concerns about your mental health, talk to your GP or call our support line on 01 249 3333. Don't wait to enjoy life again. St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. Empowering recovery.
Timber, that's Pitbull featuring Kesha. I even know what that one was. That's about 10 years old, is it? Is it Adrian? Adrian knows all these songs. He's into that. My next guest is Liz Valour here on Walk In My Shoes Radio. She's the author of Taking Flight, The Caged Bird.
Yes.
I love the title.
Well, Taking Flight, the idea of it came from Antonin Melo's book, Taking Flight. The Caged Bird was me, was my mind. And my mind was absolutely caged, I discovered, by all the beliefs and habits and programs and everything from my childhood, educational system. So all of my self-worth was caught up in all of those beliefs.
Let's go back a little bit and find out a little bit about you. Where are you from?
I'm from County Meath. I'm from...
Well, we won't hold that against you. Yeah, and your husband Francis is here as well.
He's from
Kerala.
South India, yes.
Very exotic.
And I grew up in a farming community. And my first message was when I was told, being the fourth girl, I was a disappointment. My grandmother sent a letter of condolences. So, and I know, it's really good though.
It's really good because all of the messages I was receiving at the time came from two people that weren't in touch with their own feelings, weren't in touch with their own emotions, and therefore couldn't deal with us as children. And there were nine of us. And they couldn't deal with, if you went to them, that you felt anything. They just couldn't do this. So I learned very, very quickly that you don't express yourself, you don't go to somebody to say how you feel, because it's not safe, right? So then I'm go forward and I get married and I have
just jump back a little bit. The farm, Prosperous Farm, wealthy.
Prosperous Farm.
You know,
wouldn't be wealthy, though, but definitely comfortable.
You had a television.
Yes, we had a television.
and do you mind me asking, just age group wise, so we can put you in the era?
I'm 66 now, so I was born in 1951.
So we're talking about the 50s and early 60s.
We are, yes. And that farm had been in the family for many, many generations. So if I'm to look at it from my father's point of view, he was looking for that son that was going to carry on the farm. So I was the fourth girl, so, you know, and no sign of the son.
Would you think that he felt a pressure because he hadn't produced a boy?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And that there was a stigma around that.
And my mother would have felt pressure that she hadn't produced a girl. And in his idea was she was responsible for the sex of that child, you know.
Yeah.
So that would be the way the thinking was at that time.
That maybe, I think, and I've heard a term, and I can't repeat it here, it's not a term you would repeat, but about a man who can't produce a son. And certainly among his peers, there would be pressure. And I'm imagining in the 50s and 60s, I was born in the 70s, but in the 50s and 60s, there would have been that pressure.
There was.
So that's all piling on as well.
It's all piling on.
Was it a Catholic family?
Yes, it was, yes. So you had lots going on there. But
And school, how was school?
Oh, school would have been, I was in a local national school, and that to me was okay, actually. I felt okay within that environment because you were known in that environment. So when I changed into the secondary school in Kells, it was very, very different. It was town mouse, country mouse, you had no identity. And I was very cowed by the experience. I was only nine when I went in there, and I became voiceless.
Were you a boarder?
No, I wasn't.
You were
day pupil. Yeah, rode my bicycle in and out.
So you go into the teens then, and then you know, being from a reasonably prosperous family and obviously intelligent, college beckoned or?
No. College definitely didn't beckon because in those days you had to retire on marriage.
Yes.
So my father's idea was that if he'd be wasting money on me because I'd probably get married and therefore it wouldn't come to any good. And he didn't come to the idea of sending children to college until after the two boys were born and then the next group, the next four children then. The idea then came
in. So how many in the family in total?
Nine.
So nine. First four girls?
First four girls, two boys, and then the next.
The mixture then.
And so...
And how,
all of that is in
how
there.
How close is your brother to you in age?
15 months.
In different. Could you see him being treated differently from you?
Oh, totally. Absolutely, totally. The king was born. Long live the king.
Did you get a bigger dinner? Got more dinner.
Yes, and then my other brother was born 2 years later. So then it was like the pressure was off.
So was the pressure on you then to get a job at 16 18, or 17?
18 years of age, the pressure was on. I remember my mother saying, well, you may as well just go to Dublin because there's nothing for you here. So you did. But behind that was a resilience. You did go up to Dublin and you did get yourself a job.
What kind of job did you get?
I worked in Bird's Jelly Deluxe in the order department.
That was in Dublin City Centre at the time, wasn't it?
Dublin City Centre.
Yeah,
the
factory was there up to recently.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. The smell of the jelly on you when you left in the evening because it came up from the factory.
And by the way, jelly in those days particularly was made from gelatin, which was made from bones. So it wasn't always a great smell at one part of the factory. And then they put the fruit flavour in.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Oh, I got the fruit flavour.
Oh, you got the fruit flavour. It's still there.
Yeah. I got the fruit flavour.
So you're living in Dublin and any contact with the family?
Yes, you would. See, there was contact with the family because you felt in some way responsible. I had some sort of an idea into my head I was responsible for their happiness, that I became a carer. I needed their approval. So you would be contacting because you needed approval all the time. And I was addicted to approval and I didn't realise it.
So we're in Dublin in 1968, something like that, 69 into 70.
Yeah.
The summer of love and music is happening, the hippies are about. That didn't happen in Dublin, did it?
Well, it didn't happen for me because
it
I was quite
Bird's Jelly.
Shy. Quite afraid to go out, quite afraid, you know, I was afraid, there was a lot of fear there, a lot of anxiety there, and some way or other I knew by working in Bird's it wasn't good enough, so I saw an ad for the bank, and I was able to get into the bank, the Bank of Ireland.
So having someone in the bank, that would have been something, you could tell
absolutely.
The neighbours about that, couldn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, you could tell the neighbours about
so
that.
So you went to work in the bank?
Yes, I did. And
Were you happy in the bank?
I was happy in the bank. My first post, though, was Arva, down in Cavan. So it was one street, Thursday.
And the road to Arva goes out of Oldcastle.
Oldcastle to Arva. Bally James Duff.
Yeah, BJD,
you know,
as we call it.
Exactly.
That's
yeah.
a small, Arva's a small, lovely, but it's a very small town.
I know. So you weren't allowed, there was one place where the guys in the other banks could stay in the local hotel, but girls had to stay in digs in there. So I do remember that place. And although the old lady was kind, those cats still stayed in the oven, so they did in the small oven, so she'd take them out to warm my dinner.
So can I just clarify, the cats used to stay in the oven because it was warm in the range.
Yeah, exactly.
In the range.
So the range would stay hot.
The range was never cold.
No, the range was never cold.
They never left without fuel, so the cats would live in there.
Oh, geez, yeah.
And then your dinner. That must have been some shock after being living in Dublin.
It was a shock. But then on the other hand, there was a certain sense of I was beginning again. And that's where I met my future husband.
Okay.
There.
Your then husband.
My then husband, yeah.
Not the fellow who's sitting in here with us now.
No, not the fellow who's sitting with us now. Yeah.
Francis.
Yeah.
So you meet your husband, and is that in some ways now you can take the focus away from home and start to create your own home?
Absolutely. And then I kicked in big time to pleasing him. And I found that whereas I had started really to get a sense of my own style, suddenly we're now saving to get married within 9 months and you can't have this, you can't have that, you can't have the other. And as I look back now, I see myself shrinking. Whereas I had just begun to sort of get a sense of freedom, I saw myself shrinking. But in those days, going back to then, most girls got married in around 21, 22.
So in the 1970, 71, 72?
Yeah, absolutely. 73, I got married. And again, the whole focus was on creating the home. However, my husband did want me to return to college. His mother wanted me desperately to
return. All of his mother wanted it then.
Oh,
that must have been, yeah.
Because she saw it as an insurance policy for her son. That my working in a bank, I had to retire in my marriage anyway, but I got back into
there was a marriage ban in the banks as there was in RTE and all the semi-states as well.
Yeah. So anyway, I was there, like when I see myself there now, I see myself then desperately needing her approval. So you're now
looking for more approval from.
Absolutely.
There's a big pile of people that you need to please.
Absolutely.
And your husband is big on that. So, children?
Children, four children. And so, help me God, I wanted to make them happy. And to make them happy, they couldn't suffer anything. So, I was constantly on red alert to protect them.
But can I give you, my mother used to say, we lived in a council estate, and you know, a council estate had its own problems. If there's any killing to be done on the road, I'll do it.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
So you were, the first sign of trouble, you were on it.
First sign of trouble, I was on it to protect them.
Because you couldn't fail.
No, you couldn't fail. The other thing is, I couldn't have them experiencing pain. And then when my eldest daughter was in around about 16, was about the time I realised, nothing I'm doing is creating happiness.
So we're in the mid-80s now.
We're early 92, 93, you know, we're thereabouts. And I began to see that as they went down to the world, they had no skills to deal with the difficulties that were out there, as I actually had no skills to deal with them, because it was clamp them down quickly, clamp the feeling down quickly, and that's the way I dealt with it at that time.
When did it come to a head? At what point?
It came to a head when I saw, I remember going away for a weekend and I came back in, and I saw my second daughter cooking the dinner and making it exactly as I had made it and looking after the others. And I remember looking and seeing and feeling sick. There was something about that. Instead of sort of thinking, oh my God, she's amazing, she's 14, she's doing this, I actually got sick. I said, oh my God, she's mini me. And I'm profoundly unhappy and I didn't realise it. So at that time, I was handed the book Awareness by Anthony de Mello.
You're still married at this time?
I was still married at that time.
And how was that relationship?
You see, I thought it was all right. But I suddenly realised it was all right so long as I behaved in a certain way, so long as I pleased, so long as I did. I became a human doing. I was burnt out completely trying to please people.
So you get the book, the Anthony de Mello book, and you read that book?
I read that book because he went back to college, and as he was back in college, I started to read. So I began to read Louise Hay, Susan Jeffers, Deepak Chopra. I began to read all these books. But, you know, Louise Hay, I tried all these affirmations, but sure, none of them worked. There was no point in me looking in the mirror and saying, you look beautiful, you're great, you're strong, you're this. Do you know what I mean? There was no...
I'm doing that at the moment. So you read the self-help
books.
So
I read
the ones that everybody was reading.
Absolutely. Then somebody handed me Awareness. And when I was into it, and in it he said that if you're reacting to somebody, wake up, you have a problem. It's not possible for you to make someone else happy. Something has to happen in them. And you cannot make another person love you. You've got to begin to love yourself. I think I nearly passed out when I read it because I saw the truth of it. So if I'm reacting, he said, it's triggering a past memory in you. So what is that person? That person that's annoying the living day lights out of you, that person that's bullying you, is actually showing you a part of you that's not healed. And so I set to work on me. I said, okay, I can change nothing here, but by God, I can change me. Because damned if I want my kids repeating my pattern, because they were now repeating my pattern as I was repeating my mother's pattern, as my mother repeated her mother's pattern, so something had to stop.
And like any parent, you wanted them to be different, to be better, to
absolutely.
Be you plus a half or plus three
absolutely.
Or plus four.
Absolutely, and I saw them absolutely shrinking, their confidence was shrinking. So with all this help and me doing and doing too much for them, in actual fact, I was making them dependent. I was making them run away from their feelings. Because I couldn't really listen to their feelings. I was only listening to the hurt that was inside me, and I needed to block out their feelings quick enough so that these kids then...
When did you decide that the marriage broke up?
The marriage broke up then. I realised very, very quickly that, you know, I need to really, really sit down and talk to this guy. I absolutely need... I said, look, I actually see us now like brother and sister. I don't see us as being married. It's come to a stage where I'm trying to do all these things for you and you're going and I'm helping you, but I'm helping somebody that's a friend. I'm helping somebody that's like my brother. But this is not a marriage. And I realised it wasn't a marriage. And that came as an extraordinary shock. And it was like as if then, as I began to change, I began to see the mask he had on. I began to see as I began to threaten this thing that's going on here, that he became very controlling, very manipulative. I began to see the reality of what was actually going on. So long as I behaved in a certain way, so long as I played mother to my four children and him, all would be well.
How old was your youngest at this stage?
7.
That's a tough thing to do, to have that conversation with the possibility that your marriage would break up having a 7-year-old.
Actually, at that stage, she was 5 because it was 7 when I broke up.
And did he leave the home?
He did. He left
so
the home.
So you're now at home alone with 4.
With 4.
And did you have... And I'm not saying you needed to have it or it was real, but did you have a guilt that their dad was gone because of you? That you'd forced him out?
It didn't last long, I tell you, when I saw the reality of what I was dealing with. When I saw the selfishness on his part, because he was only thinking of him. He was not thinking of the impact on the children. And I remember looking at my youngest daughter. She was coming down a slide. And I said, remember, she's your gift. And he said, will you be entitled to my mother's money if you separate from me? So I then had no guilt. Absolutely none.
So you said about working so on I yourself. Said about and I'm conscious that our time is against us, unfortunately. We're coming to the top of the hour. And your story, we could do 4 hours on this, by the way.
I know you could.
Just
do
on this first bit.
On this first bit, yeah.
Tell me about, so time moves on and you're working on yourself.
Yeah.
And obviously you're keeping a relationship between the dad and the children.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Keeping everything as much as you can.
As much as you can.
Very interested. I saw something about rebirthing. Somebody mentioned to you the word rebirthing.
I did.
Can you give me a minute on that?
It was one of the therapies I did. And it was the first place. It was a way of doing some shallow breathing. What I was trying to do is bring some of these memories back to the surface. And I saw many of the memories where, you know, I wasn't listened to or whatever. But now I realized, okay, right, I can listen to me through my relationship with you. So if you are annoying me, I can find out what's going on inside me, because I have attracted you for some reason to show me a mirror of what's happening inside me. So I know that sounds complicated, but say, for example, you are very strong and you're keeping to your thing. If I see that, all right, okay, that's my fear around authority. And initially, I have to go away and look and see my fear around authority. And then I think, okay, that's the 3-year-old kid. Now, what is this 42-year-old going to do about it now? So the 42-year-old had to go off, rehearse, and then use Louise Hay's affirmations. I can do this.
Now you're ready
yes,
for them.
Yes, I can do. Now I'm ready for them. And I'd walk the dog around Leopardstown Racecourse at that time to give me the courage to speak. And as I did each one of those, it was like an internal detox. So the more I was able to detox that hurt, actually what it did was I was able to love unconditionally. Because as before this, because I couldn't love myself, I'm looking out to you to approve of me so I can love me. Right? Now, as I began to love myself and feel respect for myself and think, geez, you actually do have some integrity, I was then able to be present for you. So I was more present for my kids. I was able to see their individuality.
How are they now?
My eldest daughter is in Melbourne, and she, who didn't believe in herself when that happened, is now an environmental scientist. My second daughter, she was the national trainer, a makeup artist for Yves Saint Laurent in Australia, and now she's moved to New York. My son took up sports science and nutrition, personal training, and he's also the fitness trainer and health trainer for Team Wellington, as well as doing personal training. And my youngest daughter is an amazing photographer. She's in Toronto. She was here doing freelance, doing L. Keegan photography, and every single one of them are doing something that is theirs. Whereas before, I would have loved them to go into a secure job, maybe in a bank, or a secure job teaching like I was in teaching, or whatever. But it was quite an extraordinary journey.
Well, Liz, that's only a tiny piece of your story. Your husband is here, your now husband as well,
yes.
Francis Valera, and he's not telling you anything what to do. I can tell you, he's sitting there quietly.
Yeah.
Well, you're totally in control.
I practice my awareness also on him too.
The name of the book is
Taking Flight,
The Caged Bird. Where can we buy that?
You can buy it in Dubray, Avoca Handweavers, on our website, valourinstitute.com. So it's VALLOR. And you can actually, if you want to go onto our mailing list, because I'm giving some programs now on Too Nice for Your Own Good, and I'm beginning to write the second book, Still Too Nice for Your Own Good.
Still too nice for your uncle. Liz Valera, thank you so much. And I'm sorry, apologies for cutting it short.
Thank you.
We're hitting the top of the hour. Alison Curtis is coming on next. And